Hi, everybody. This is Dean Haglund from the Offices of Rational Exuberance here.
What just was that?
That was the email leaving.
I'm sorry. And I interrupted you, which like I said that I was never going to. No, I haven't been doing it. Start again. That scared me. That's not my fault. I'm like a horse at the, you know, at the starting gate.
You're listening to Phil Lernest, my scaredy cat co-producer, co-host of your Chill Pack Hollywood Hour.
Who are you?
I'm Dean Haglund.
Where are we?
In the Offices of Rational Exuberance, in the heart of the historic core.
High atop the heart of the historic core.
In the Eastern Columbia building.
The Art Deco masterpiece?
By Claude Biellman. Other architectural pieces he's done, including the Hollywood U.S. Postal Office, anyway, look him up. He's done a lot architecturally.
And of course, to all our Jackalope radio listeners, is Dean Haglund's Chill Pack Hollywood Hour.
Oh, okay, we'll change that eventually.
Everyone else, it's your Chill Pack Hollywood Hour.
Clearly, it's a bone of contention between us. The tension you could feel through the airwaves here in the offices.
I've been meaning to talk to you about feeling the tension.
Anyway, what a show we have for you.
Do we?
Oh, my gosh.
Speaking of shows, yeah, you what a show you had for people on Saturday, from what I've heard.
You heard that?
From you.
I didn't say a thing about it. It was the Zodiac Thriller Show, where the Leo team won over Aries, Pisces, and some other
architects. Dean Haglund joined a cult.
No, what happens is improvisers group together based on their zodiac sign, improvise together, and then see who wins. So Leo won that Saturday. We play Virgo next Saturday, and then
it's like the houses at Hogwarts, Gryffindor, kind of Slytherin. Yeah. And
you don't wear a hat though. It's just how you lay it out.
And where was this?
This was at the Bang Studios. This is right on Fairfax, just down from Cantor's. And it's a little theater, improv theater, that's been there for a couple of years, started by Peter Marietta and, you know, Peter.
Eliza Marietta.
And Eliza Marietta. Yeah. Sure. You know Eliza?
The Marietta's from the old Acme Comedy Theater days.
The Acme Comedy Theater in Second City alumni. And Peter couldn't be there because he was out winning the Emmy Award for his show that he's been working on, which the name of which I forget. I'm so sorry, Peter. Big show.
So was it a good turnout?
It was a lovely turnout. Big laughs all around.
Who was on your team?
Well, there was Phil and Dan. And
they're good.
They're good guys. And Cliff was hilarious.
So you beat one other team?
Four other teams. Yeah, you get 15 minutes of stage time, and they do four at a time so that the whole month they can determine who's the best. So it used to be like a two-month thing.
So I see. So it'll be 3 weeks with four teams each week.
Yeah.
And each team gets 15 minutes.
Yeah.
And
the end of it.
And what might the improv be that you have for 15 minutes? I don't understand.
It's an open. You can get a suggestion or you can just start go.
So you get to script your own, or not you script. Get to unscript.
You get to unscript your own
You
show.
Get to create your own playlist.
Yep.
For the unscripted, your own games as they are.
And they're not even games. It's just open. You don't stop the scene. You just, you go.
Is
and
it
then,
one scene for 15 minutes?
It could be, but it basically, it weaves in and out. People come in and...
Basically, you're doing a show for 15 minutes.
Yeah.
And whichever one of those teams does the best improv show for 15 minutes...
Based on audience voting.
Based on audience voting, wins and
advances.
Big cash prizes and advances to the next round.
Yes. No cash prizes.
It's all for charity.
It's all for charity. That but true.
So, and everything you do, you do for the kids.
I do. Like your Chill Pack Hollywood Hour. It's for you.
Dean Haglund, for me.
Well,
now that I'm all freshly shaven, by the way.
I
clean
saw that.
Shaven.
I was going to say something.
I look like one of the kids.
What happened?
Yeah, I know. What happened?
The goatee's gone.
Every 3 years, I get clean shaven whether I need to or not. You know, 2007 was the last time.
Yeah.
And the last time before that was while we were shooting Spectres.
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah.
When I had the goatee.
Exactly.
That was the weird thing.
Oh.
It's the transference.
We constantly become shadowy reflections upon each other. I'll be doing an improv comedy show next.
You will?
No, I won't.
What?
You know what my sign is, though?
What?
Slippery when wet.
Oh, I was going to say no shoulders.
Caution, men working. Slow children at play.
Slow
children at play is the best one. Because it's the fast children you have to worry about.
End construction.
Now, I want to know more about this, just in the sense. So again, there's no guidelines, no rules imposed upon you at all.
No structure per se. There's no like, oh, you have to do this game and this game or anything like
that. Just, it has to be 15 minutes. Like it has to be improv.
Yeah, there's a version of improv called The Herald, which basically you get one word and everybody improvises off of that and you reincorporate elements back into it as the scenes go on. And some say there is a structure to that, and some say you throw away the structure as soon as you learn it. There's, you know, all sorts of things. So,
and are props allowed?
There are allowed, but there's no prop case. There's no prop. The stage is bare.
But I mean, you could bring your own props.
I could bring a box of props if I chose to.
But is that kind of frowned upon? I mean,
You know, there's some groups that love the props and some that don't. Yeah. But then if you have your own box of props and then you like suddenly bring them out, it doesn't seem like you're improvising anymore.
No, exactly.
Right? It seems like, oh, you have this character, you know this gag, you always bring out the rubber chicken sort of thing.
So it just feels a little bit like Carrot Top.
When you're traveling with a semi of props around the country.
So does this mean now that you will be going back there in a few weeks?
In one week. The 24th is the big final.
Okay.
I think Virgo won and
so there'd be only three teams.
There'd be three teams.
You each get 20 minutes.
Wow. And then somebody gets a prize at the end of that.
Wow. What's the prize?
I believe it's a decorated bottle of Coca-Cola.
No. I might have to come to this show.
You might.
On next Saturday. I won't cheer loudly for you.
No. I insist you don't. But you can vote.
Right. But I thought, how do you vote?
There's a little slip of paper.
Oh, I thought it was by applause.
No. Oh, all right. No, you get to vote anonymously.
You know how I feel about voting.
I know how you do.
One shouldn't do it because it only encourages them.
Exactly. Why, you haven't voted in an election?
If we held an election and nobody showed up,
we wouldn't have any.
Yeah, would it count?
Would it count? It still does, unfortunately.
Well, yeah. I mean, a whole lot of people turn out, and it apparently doesn't count anyway.
Yeah.
Oh, look at me,
Mr. Pessimistic.
Bitter.
Fight the power.
Fight the power.
And then I saw Inception finally.
We have a lot to talk about in terms of movies. I mean, why don't we start with Inception and then we'll get back
because
to the news.
Because you saw it weeks ago and I said, don't say a thing about it because I don't want it spoiled.
Okay.
And then I saw it and I go, well, anybody could have talked about this because it wouldn't have spoiled the thing.
Of course not.
Yeah. There's no spoilage to be had.
No.
There's like, of course, you knew all along he's going into dreams.
Right.
And there's different levels of dreams.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, it's not like, you know.
Right.
He doesn't meet Bobby Ewing in a shower.
Thankfully.
Yeah.
That could have happened, right?
We see him planting that idea in the writer's mind.
That's right. That was the inception. Make it a dream.
Yeah, it was, I thought, quite a rewarding movie. And as I said before, old friend Tom Hardy really, really is a scene stealer in this thing.
That's right. He played...
He's the thief.
The thief. Yeah.
Or the forger. I'm
the
sorry,
forger.
The forger.
Yes. Yeah,
so great. Yeah.
I thought he was totally the
hot off a very successful British television performance as Heathcliff in Wuthering Heights.
Really?
Yeah.
BBC little.
So
thing?
he is
on fire,
gangbusters right now, and he's
and
getting leads
how?
In big movies. And
you went to school with him.
No, I know him because for a brief period of time, he was going to be playing the lead in a movie called Illumination.
Oh, yeah.
After he had been Shinzon in the Star Trek Nemesis.
That's right.
Movie that killed the franchise. Not his fault, though.
Not his fault. He did an admirable job for what was written.
He played the part of the cloned Picard.
Yes.
And they wanted somebody who could match Patrick Stewart. I mean, that's complimentary casting.
That's an audition you got to work on.
Right at that point, he had been fresh off an Olivier Award on British stage. And so he was a comer.
Look at him. And now he's arrived.
And he had another wonderful turn in... what was the supposedly going to be the Guy Ritchie comeback with...
Sherlock Holmes?
No, that was the Guy Ritchie comeback.
Oh,
but
the
do you
one
remember
before that, yeah.
Rock and Rolla?
Rock and Rolla.
With who's the guy that's everywhere? The guy from 300, but
yes,
who's yet to find any other hit.
Gerard Butler.
Gerard Butler, yeah. He had a nice turn in Rock and Rolla,
yeah.
Tom Hardy, but anyway.
Yeah. Anyway, so there you go, Christopher Nolan.
It's wonderful.
Yeah, did you really enjoy it?
I really enjoyed it, yeah.
I would think there were some things you would nitpick about it.
Like what?
I don't know.
I don't remember now anything that I would nitpick. And I also think it's the sort of film that before one starts to pick a nit, one should go back and watch it again.
Oh, yeah?
I don't think that it's, you know, one of the things that I am sensitive to is all the criticism that people will knee-jerk make. And if they'd paid a little bit closer attention... you know what? The problem is with thou.
Well, I would think your expert in dream analysis would be somewhat...
I decided to hold off from that standpoint.
Really?
I decided to be a little bit more like an objective juror. Yeah. You're not supposed to lean on your expert information in a jury until you go back later and reassess. Then maybe, of course, you're bringing your own experience into it. But when listening to the testimony, you need to be open and you need to be objective. Ah. And, of course, the first rule for any film, for any creative enterprise, is it not,
mm-hmm.
is to establish the rules within that world and live up to them.
Right.
Live up to the rules you've created. Now we can then go and nitpick again about approaching it in terms of
why can't
of dreams.
This person wake up and that
but,
person.
You know, for a film like that, if you're, I think, assessing it from that standpoint the first time you see it, you're never going to be open to certainly the richness that does work anyway.
Right.
Because you're in altogether the wrong
frame,
yeah,
of mind.
Frame to be able to witness something like
right,
that.
Right.
Yeah.
Interesting. So
and you know, as much as we talk about this and approaching movies a different way or whatever, you know, I keep getting back to the fact that it couldn't be further from the truth that I go in to watch movies differently than most people do. Although I think maybe a lot of people do go into movies, you know, because they cost so much money and to go and see something, people do go in going, God, I hope I didn't make a mistake.
Right.
You know, which is why I think that exit scores for movies, these cinema scores, are always so good, even for terrible movies,
right.
on opening night. Like if a movie like Piranha 3D or something gets a B cinema score, a B.
A B.
A B is a good grade,
that's
right?
A good grade.
But no, everybody knows in the business that a B is like an F.
Right.
Because opening night... Everybody's inclined
so
to say
excited.
They love it.
Right.
And the reason that people are inclined to say they love it is because they just paid money for it. And if they hated it, then aren't they the fool?
Right.
For wasting their money. Nobody wants to feel they wasted their money. Very few people do. No. Some people will go to see things because they want the experience of seeing something they know is going to be bad.
Right.
You know, the bloody car wreck on the side of the road kind of thing. But this is why you take the same film... You see its exit scores from a paid audience versus its test scores from an audience that was seeing it for free. The test scores are always much, much lower.
Yeah.
For the same movie.
For the same movie. Because it's the assessed value that you put with that dollar sign to the thing.
Right.
It's much like the modern art world. Like, why is one painting worth $50 million when the other one is... as equally good in one's eyes.
I really believe that it's also the way in terms of employees are probably valued no matter what the field is. Obviously, this is dependent upon the wisdom and the insight of the person doing the analysis. But
right.
if we can say that the certain type of mid-level management characteristics prone to be in the possession of the person making these assessments, then I think most of the time, you know, there's a tendency to think that the person who's being paid more is doing better.
Exactly. Though you look at the CEO of Kaiser Permanente, clearly he is not a billion-dollar CEO, even though his salary is $1 billion.
Perhaps.
Yes.
Perhaps not.
I don't think he's really worth that.
But so when I approach these films, you know, look, I still want that experience of being absolutely taken by the movie and believing in this world
and
believing
in
these characters. And that every time I go in, that's what I want. And every time I go into the theater, I want to believe in the authenticity of these characters, that these characters are real, that this is. And when it's just that less and less often does one have that experience?
Right.
And what happens is quicker, you know, earlier and earlier in the process when that experience isn't happening, when I'm denied that, then I go to the place of, okay, what just happened?
Why did that choice fall apart?
Why was that choice made? You know, so that I'm having a worthwhile experience regardless of the quality of the film because I'm learning something the whole time.
And this is the whole point of living here in Los Angeles is you finally realize nobody goes out of the way to make a bad movie.
Right.
The movies are bad because something went wrong in a group dynamic.
Well, I guess we should just get into the movie discussion now because I also think now there's a new piece that I add to it that I'm really starting. We've talked about marketing so much on this show.
Absolutely.
And I'm really becoming aware now, as I've mentioned over the last few, especially this summer, that my enjoyment of a film, I'm really shocked at how much it is affected by expectation. That are often imposed upon me.
By the ad campaign?
You know, or by having seen the trailer.
Yeah.
I told you about Winter's Bone. If I'd seen the trailer in advance...
You would have hated it.
Yeah, or I wouldn't have even seen it.
Right. Like I finally saw...
I didn't know how they were marketing it. And because I didn't know how they were marketing it, it was a very rich film.
Right.
The trailer I thought looked terrible, having seen the trailer after the fact... And it wasn't just that they were marketing a film that I didn't see, you know, this thriller, the suspense thriller.
Yeah.
Are there moments that are suspenseful? Perhaps. You know, are there moments that are thrilling? Absolutely. But to market something as a suspense thriller is to set up expectations and certain promises, and that this film was never aimed to deliver. If you just watch the film.
Ah.
Of course, the marketing department is tasked with getting as many butts in the seat as possible. So that's what they do. And in this particular case, though, the trailer itself, and we've seen many films where, or at least we've seen some films where the trailer was good and intriguing, and the movie was good, only the trailer and the movie weren't the same.
Right, yeah.
You know, and there's a disconnect.
Totally.
This is a case where the trailer isn't any good. And the reason that the trailer isn't any good was that the decision was made at some level to market it in a certain way, but there wasn't enough footage to support that marketing.
Ah.
You couldn't just cherry pick clips that would make it seem that way.
Right.
You know, truth is out there, our documentary, I could cherry pick clips to show that the film is one thing,
right,
if I wanted to. And it could be a variety of different one things. So the challenge is...
How do you make it all things?
Well, try to live up to what we say on this show, which is really reflect what the film is.
Yeah.
Be honest, because the film deserves to make its own friends. And ultimately, over the long run, the best way to do that is by being honest about what the film really is.
Right. And this is so often the case, is that you see the executives panicking, thinking that there's no audience for this film or whatever.
Or getting greedy.
Right?
We need, is going to be loved by this quadrant and this quadrant.
Right.
What if we can get that quadrant over there?
Right. Because you see these execs go to Comic-Con, see 300,000 people crammed in the thing and going, oh my God, this must be just 10% of an audience that's out there. Let's make a movie. Scott Pilgrim versus the World, say.
This is one of the ones that I wanted to talk about.
And then go, we can just connect to that crowd and get everybody who goes to that convention to come to this movie will be billionaires 10 times over.
So anyway, to sum up, you know, what I've really learned about myself over the last few weeks is that I really was shocked, since we've been having these discussions about marketing and about being honest about a film, I really have been shocked at how much my enjoyment of a film is affected by what I know going in. And if I'm affected when I already am aware of this and am on guard about this, well then, of course,
everybody,
the audience paying their money is, because you know what? They don't have a podcast where they're sitting around talking about this all the time.
Right. Not... They could listen to it.
And it really is sometimes so sadly unfair to films.
Oh, I thought you were going to say sadly unfair that they don't all have a podcast.
It is that, too.
Sadly unfair.
I would love to hear people's podcasts about what they do for a living. I would indeed. That's actually true. It's like when I travel around, you know, when people always want to talk about, like, what we talk about on the show because they think, well, this is what interests us. And then it's like, no, you know, we talk about this because this is what we do. I kind of like traveling around hearing about what other people do.
Exactly.
I like hearing, because that's interesting.
Yeah.
It's not like this is particularly interesting to me. It's just what I know.
It's just what we know.
So I've been trying to be, you know, really aware of that, of my own approach to it going in. Or like I would say, right, with the skeptic versus believer debate in conspiracies when we were making this film, the weakness of the best skeptics is that they are so rigorous in their scholarship,
right,
that individuals will have different blind spots, but as a collective group, even the best skeptics, because of their scholarship, I think because they're so focused on a real rigorous
scholastic
approach to this, which is based on their own integrity.
Right.
I don't mean to be criticizing them, but it became very apparent to me in reading these works that a blind spot develops through nothing less than approaching your own trade with integrity, and that is, it becomes very easy to forget to apply that same rigorous skepticism to your own skepticism.
Right. How do you do that?
You know, to have faith in your own skepticism versus to remain skeptical about your skepticism.
So that
to always be aware.
I'm supposed to be skeptical of my skepticism.
Absolutely.
Therefore, I have tons of faith. Therefore, I take it at face value.
No, you know,
it's a double negative, isn't it?
No, it's to hold both. It's to hold. It's to hold faith and doubt. Because let me say this so often with the conspiracists, right? What we've seen is they're telling the exact same story. You know, again, the 9/11 is a great example for me. You know, I hear all these truthers and all these theories, and at the end of the day, it is no different than the official story.
Right.
It's no different because it's all about people working in the dark to terrorize us
in some capacity,
to take away our freedom of choice, our freedom, our rights, whatever it is. And so it's the same story. And so all you've done is replace one them versus another them. And so you have to be very skeptical of that. Or you have to maintain a certain amount of faith in things. That's the balance that is required, because otherwise so much, you know, as we've seen, you're led down the rabbit hole from powerlessness right back to powerlessness.
Right.
With skepticism, you know, it's very interesting because they will acknowledge that they are skeptics, they are doubters, they are rationalists.
Right.
They also have an extraordinary amount of faith, and it's a faith in their own skepticism. And that's what I'm saying, you know, is interesting.
Right.
If you are going to be skeptical, you have to look at where your blind spot is. What are you taking on faith? And what they're taking on faith is their own skepticism.
That's such a labyrinth of...
Well, and so this is what I'm doing with film, right? I know this, these things about marketing and about what the film really is and coming to it, it's on its own terms.
Right.
I should not have so much faith in my own knowledge in this, not to keep questioning myself.
Right.
Just because I know it doesn't mean I'm not being affected by it.
Right. And then to realize you are affected by it then questions your own knowledge of it.
Yeah.
Because
yeah.
You then go, well, you know, it's true. I haven't sat in a marketing meeting at Warner Brothers in quite a few years now. I'm sure the advances have, you
well,
know.
So this is, it's an interesting time to be talking about this because it does. It creates a new set of experiments then. I'm going to watch this film without knowing anything about it.
Right.
I'm going to watch this directly from the standpoint of what I know about it. And at the same time, I'm going to see if I can market the film that I'm making in the way that we've been saying we would like to see films market.
Right.
Can I be the change that I have said I want to see? That's and right. Is that right? Truth is out there. I showed you the trailer last week. You liked it. I showed the trailer to our producer, Lyle Scozzi. He was very excited about it. Had some suggestions of changes. And one of the suggestions that he had, very interesting, was to include a different clip at the end from therapist Dr. Nicky Monte. Said that that just hits so much harder, this other clip. You know, and I was quick to say, oh, Lyle doesn't get it. Lyle doesn't get it. And then, you know, never mind that I actually had that clip in there beforehand and was pointed, had it pointed out to me. Aren't you giving away too much by including that clip?
Mm.
And yes, I was. The very reason that it hits so much is that it does.
Does give away the whole thing.
Button something, and we see that in trailers all the time.
Right.
So no, but I learned something in that, which is how easy it is to forget that you're giving something away.
Right. Because you're so immersed in it that you don't realize what...
This is a great thing about it. I want to share it.
I want to share it. And then you just pitch the whole thing and nobody needs to see it.
Yeah. And we've had that experience so much.
So much. And in fact, Wendy and Lucy, that movie I just saw finally.
Right.
The woman who loses her dog.
Right.
That marketed to me as this thoughtful, heartfelt journey. And then I see it and I thought it was terrible. I hated that movie. I'm sorry. There was no heart.
I don't think that there were, other than, along with Frozen River, I don't think that there have been two more effective films depicting the true nature of the economic life of this country.
Well, that's true. I'll give you the true nature of the economic life. That may be the case, but I thought that the...
And she was very real.
Okay. Whatever. The trailer for me showed a much more deeper personal
journey.
But
see, I never saw a trailer.
See, and that ruined it for me.
Yeah.
Because they sort of gave it, they gave it more than the actual movie had going for it.
No, and it is very much a very simple slice of life.
Too simple for my taste.
And although, but the simplicity denied how profound it was, because the whole movie is about letting go.
Yes.
And how the only way to survive the economic climate in which we live is to be ready at all times to just let go.
Of your dog.
Yeah, well.
Or of anything.
Yeah.
But the dog is a metaphor.
But if dog is a metaphor of all loyalty, and we're taught that loyalty is so important.
Job loyalty.
Yeah.
Yeah, all of that.
But there, no loyalty exists.
No.
So, I think that, I didn't see the marketing campaign.
See, that's
so I was able to be aware of the really, but that's the nature, isn't it, of metaphor, of allegory. It can be very fragile.
Yes. That's right, and it has to work within the context of society, because then that metaphor, I mean, you look at Renaissance paintings, all of these allegorical stories from the Bible told in paintings now are completely lost on us. All you see is a bunch of people standing in awkward poses with an angel and something flying over their head.
And when I was bagging on Da Vinci not too long ago,
yes,
this
is
the thing, because it shocks me, you know, that... But just this whole idea that he encoded these messages and encoded these messages. And my point was, you know, I never particularly was a big fan of his painting, so I guess I could believe that he wasn't an artist at all and that he was
scientist
just
encoding
consciously messages.
Into.
On the other hand, isn't it possible that we've just lost the ability to read the allegory and the metaphor?
That is also possible.
And so...
Or replace it with...
And so we've replaced it with...
Our own allegory, metaphor.
Which is what we do even about contemporary art.
It's true.
You know?
Yeah, that you just...
Chris Carter knows what's really going on. And he's telling us in the... Or he's a storyteller.
Or he's a storyteller, and you've read a bunch of stuff into it.
Yeah.
Which is what artists do.
And you're now rewriting the real world to reflect what you saw in...
Which is probably why you like David Lynch so much. Because you read so much into his spaghettis that he throws to the...
No, world. I don't read anything into it. I just understand that at his best, no filmmaker makes more emotional sense than David Lynch does.
Hmm.
From an intellectual standpoint, you're going down...
Yeah, okay.
You've missed the point if you're trying to start analyzing it in those terms.
Ouch. Yeah. You gave me a miss the point phrase?
Yeah.
Bastard. Yeah. Well, maybe that's true. I'll look at another David Lynch movie 80 years from now.
which would give you, if you started now, give you just enough time to get through half of Inland Empire. So I went and saw.
What'd you see?
I saw a couple of films here.
I'm dying
that
to hear
you had seen to have this discussion, because it became apparent to me that there are films that are being made for and aimed at the youth market that are completely, completely failing to interest them or attract them or satisfy them in any way.
Right.
And the two films of recent memory, and you know, every movie is comic books.
Right.
But both based on comic books, both huge failures at the box office. Kick-Ass,
yeah,
and Scott Pilgrim versus the World.
Two of my favorite films of recent time.
And I would argue that that's exactly the problem.
They're my favorite films?
Lyle loved, he said, oh my God, Kick-Ass is such a great movie. And I go, see, that's proof that it's a terrible movie. Because if a man in his mid-40s is saying this is exactly, you know right. what? Not a cool movie. And I mean this because all these movies, and here was my experience with Kick-Ass, which I thought was not a good movie.
Right.
I thought it was a very interesting movie that does not work, and it doesn't really work from a whole lot of levels, but it was very interesting. But my experience with it was, in the first half hour, I go, okay, this is really interesting what they're deconstructing here.
Right.
And at the same time, I'm questioning, and again, I didn't bother knowing anything about it in advance other than the fact that you liked it, and like two-thirds of the critics liked it, and everybody was baffled, well, why would audiences stay awake? Comic book, action movie, kids movie,
everything.
Pop culture, you know.
Explosions.
Nobody goes to see it, even though it got good reviews. And it's like, well, first of all, kids don't give a rat's ass about reviews.
True.
That's only going to help with a certain class of adults, right. i.e. us.
Right.
And that's not going to make a movie like that a hit.
That's right.
And I knew it was directed by Matthew Vaughn, who made the very good Layer Cake, which is the reason we have Daniel Craig as James Bond.
That's right.
You know, he kind of reinvented that
genre.
That genre, the Guy Ritchie genre of gangster, British gangster films. But in the first half hour, where it was very intriguing, I wondered, why is Matthew Vaughn directing this? I don't see any fingerprints on this movie at all.
Interesting, that's true.
Then, at about the half hour mark, or thereabouts, then it becomes his film. And I felt it stopped at that point being kind of the rich, again, metaphor that it could have been.
Oh.
Because now it became way too gritty and grounded in a certain reality, a reality of the filmmaker's making, of within that world. But at that moment, then any kind of universality of it was lost. The kind of universality that would appeal on a visceral level to younger viewers.
Oh, that's interesting.
It is rewarding almost only on a certain intellectual level, not on a visceral level that young audiences would like. You know, it requires a certain experience and awareness of the media, awareness of the genre as a whole.
Productions that came before.
And you know, it's really interesting, all these comic book movies, because, you know, you flash back 30 years ago, it was Superman. It's hard to remember this, but 33 years ago, 32 years ago, Superman not only convinced you that a man could fly, but it convinced you that a comic book could be made into a real movie. Before then, that idea was a joke.
Yeah, that was ridiculous.
A real movie made of a comic book? Now, look at where we're at. Jon Favreau wanted to direct the Avengers movie, but he's too expensive. Marvel doesn't want to use him anymore. They're not even going to use him for Iron Man 3 because they can get basically A-list talents to work much cheaper because they want to reach a large audience. So Joss Whedon is a cheap alternative to Jon Favreau.
Wow.
Whedon, who made Buffy
what?
And Firefly and Serenity, he's a cheap alternative to Jon Favreau, and so desperate, I guess, to reach an audience that, okay, yeah, I'll make your Marvel comic book movie. Every, like, really good Matthew Vaughn is making a comic book movie. You know, and again, I would never deny anyone a payday. And if they, you know, think they're going to, you know, reach an audience or whatever the reasons are.
Right.
But it's so interesting because, again, what serious filmmaker, edgy indie filmmaker or otherwise, was going to be making comic book movies really until Tim Burton.
Until Tim Burton did that.
Did it.
That's right.
In 89. And that's still only 20 years ago.
And what else has happened is all the screenplays that are having trouble being produced are then finding illustrators to turn it into a graphic novel slash comic book in order to get the traction it needs to get back into the movie form that it was originally. So everybody now is sort of cross-feeding itself until it devours its own tail. And, you know,
anyway,
to where it's a point we are now.
So I didn't enjoy
Kick-Ass.
I didn't think Kick-Ass was good. I didn't think it was bad, but I thought it was a failure. And I thought it wasn't a failure, you know, as opposed to probably you and Lyle, because I have a far healthier relationship to my childhood than
what the fuck is what?
Nevertheless, this is what I would, you know, I'm starting to become aware of, though. And again, Scott Pilgrim is a really interesting, you know, comparison.
Example.
Also, because this is a movie where I come down on the side of this is a very inventive movie. This is very clever. This is a lot of fun.
Yeah.
Clever being the word.
Yeah.
You know, the truth is, again, this is not something men like us appreciate cleverness more than, let's say, other people do. Certainly
the
women.
Or women. Sure.
Cleverness can be really tiresome after a while. You know, you want to go deeper at some point. I thought Scott Pilgrim was truly an amazing achievement by director Edgar Wright in that it is as close as you can come to making a good movie when the lead character doesn't work at all. Because he's just so badly miscast.
It's
so badly miscast. You know, as Lily said walking out, what were they doing making this movie if girls couldn't find the lead attractive?
Yeah, and he's supposed to have all these girlfriends.
And as you said, that there was, in the comic book, there was a cool factor to him. And of course, Michael Cera doesn't have that at all. You know what? Michael Cera does what Michael Cera does to the fullest extent in this movie. He does it very well. Michael Cera showed some different moves, some different range a little bit. He showed his development as an actor. It's not that he's bad. It's just that he's wrong.
Right.
And proof that he's wrong, people, is that no young people want to see this movie. I see it on an afternoon screening. There's no one under 40
in
the theater.
Interesting.
And
but there's another thing, and I'll speak from my Twilight thing, my experience with the tweens.
Okay.
And that's my niece included, is that the way they see movies now isn't you read a review and then you go find the theater. It's that a group of your friends, let's go out, you find yourself at the mall multiplex thing, and then you look up at the marquee and you sort of through sort of washy derisive, everybody agrees on a movie and goes in.
Okay. So you're saying that these kids today, blah, 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 blah.
The kids today.
Okay, the kids are the ones going to see Inception more than once. The kids are the ones going to see Avatar more than once. You know, it's
because everybody can agree on it in the group setting.
Well, but see,
there's a groupthink.
No, I think, but that's not true because, again, as we just said, you know, look, I knew what was cool when I was a kid when I found out who didn't like it.
Right. Okay.
You know?
So that.
So you've got
to.
Most kids don't want to be liking the thing that mom and dad like. Most don't.
Right.
And because they are individuating, it's an important thing. It is, however, possible as a storyteller to speak to all ages without speaking down to any of them.
Right.
And that's where I think with these movies, the Scott Pilgrim, the Kick-Ass, you've got kind of a mixed message in terms of the medium and the approach to it.
Interesting. See where you're going.
The people who are running things, who from a marketing standpoint, from a studio standpoint, green lighting things, making movies, are generally white men of a certain age.
Right.
And we can look around culturally and understand that there has not been a letting go of childhood in a way that previous generations did let go of childhood. And not only that, there is a reward
system
for not letting go of childhood.
Right.
We're right. Hello, Tim Burton. We're right back to there. I mean,
Will Ferrell.
Doesn't that kind of announce it? Yeah. So the not letting go of childhood. And this has all created sort of a very interesting now relationship to childhood. And what I'm seeing in these movies start to emerge is men in their 30s and now 40s greenlighting, marketing, making movies that have a bit of anger, resentment, and bitterness towards their youth.
Interesting.
That was not in these kind of movies before.
Huh. And so that there's a darker element of, and that violence and all of that.
I wouldn't say necessarily dark. Dark, young people do love dark.
You're
but
right.
Bitterness is different.
Hmm.
And so there's a bitterness towards these things. You know, Michael Cera, the casting of him, very interesting, right? Because why? Why did they cast him? I mean, they spent...
What do you think? The Q rating with the kids?
Well, I think they thought, well, we're going to let Edgar Wright make and invent a movie. We're going to do this. We're rolling the dice. It's a ballsy move making this, this property. But as we've talked about before, then the risk management kicks in.
That's right.
It is a risk. So let's try to manage the risk by getting a name to play Scott Pilgrim. So Michael Cera, he's the right age, and he was in a comedy, Superbad, that made $100 million. What better way to manage our risk than the right age, $100 million box office in a comedy? Perfect.
Perfect.
We're aces.
Yeah.
Did young people make Superbad have a $100 million box office?
No.
Or was it largely people like us looking back on those years and appreciating
The
relationship between Michael Cera and Jonah Hill.
Hmm.
The people I always heard talk about it were older folks.
Yeah.
And again, critics loved it and adult audiences loved it. So they might have wanted to look deeper into their demographic material because, again, Michael Cera's career launched with Arrested Development.
Right.
Arrested Development, not a show that the kids supported.
True enough. Yeah.
Critics, adults, etc.
Right. So it's what you're saying is Michael Cera is actually an avatar, as it were, for 40-year-olds who are bitter at their childhood or who thought they themselves were geeky and nerdy and much like Michael Cera, so that they can see the everyman in their past as opposed to the way we used to see the everyman in Tom Hanks in the future.
Yeah, and maybe it's not even necessarily the bitterness. And, you know, I didn't like write this down or think this through or whatever, but I just became aware of there is a disconnect.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, it is so important, is it not, for filmmakers and storytellers, if they are going to appeal to all audiences, if they're going to speak to all audiences without speaking down any of them, they have to maintain a healthy childlike sense.
Right.
Spielberg, in his formative years, certainly captured that, right? Why does E.T. speak to all ages? Raiders of the Lost Ark, these Close Encounters of the Third Kind.
Had this wonder and sense of innocence to
wonder
it.
And innocence that could appeal to all with the intelligence of an adult, the sensitivity of an adult. And so that's always the... Richard Donner in the first Superman movie. He made a movie that adults could like. He was an adult filmmaker. Richard Donner is an adult.
Yeah.
And yet he brought such a wonder and innocence to that material.
Right.
And now what's very interesting is that there is just this disconnect between the wonder and innocence, and there's much more a commenting upon those years and that stage of development.
Right.
Kick-Ass and Scott Pilgrim are very much about commenting on that age.
That's the thing. Right. Which was always a trouble in improv comedies. How to play a character that you know is either bad or goofy or stupid and be that character and not comment on it through gags and stuff like that. Because that sort of takes everybody out. And while it may be getting laughs, it isn't, from an acting standpoint, fantastic. You know, doesn't really fulfill the scene in an improv comedy situation. So it's interesting that, I think that this was the This was a problem you saw a lot in improv comedy, and that's now seemed to take into the screen.
Yeah, I mean, there's so much commenting going on, and I think that's why.
And what do comic books do?
But if you're if you are that age, are you interested in seeing adults commenting?
Yeah.
On the age you are.
Because then it's, what do you know about it?
Yeah.
Yeah. I could see that totally being pissing me off. If I were, you know, that age right now and seeing all this, it would seem as false as Annette Funicello in the Beach Bank and Bingo movies of the,
interesting,
of the 50s. You know?
That's very interesting. Yeah.
That could be that whole thing all over again. Interesting. Wow.
All right.
Now I'm going to see all these movies again.
I wanted to revisit a couple of things because since you mentioned, you know, on last week's show about the controversy surrounding the mosque in near Ground Zero in the Burlington Coat Factory. Boy, I'm hearing about this from everyone.
Everyone now.
Everybody weighs in on this.
It's true. What did we say last week? We said how ridiculous.
Yeah, I guess. I mean, I'm kind of stunned that it's sort of gotten to this point. I was aware that families of the victims of 9/11 have started to come forward and say, look, you know, this kind of intolerance is not the legacy that we would like our loved one's death to leave behind.
Right.
And, you know, it is such a tremendous opportunity, it seems to me, this symbol of a mosque near Ground Zero and the building of it and the coming together. There's such an opportunity for healing here.
Right. And why isn't that being taken?
Are there no... And again, I haven't been paying attention to this because I've been editing, but are there no leaders coming forward and taking positions of leadership about the fact that, look, that which wounds us offers us the opportunity to be healed?
Well, no. That's the interesting thing. No one is doing that because it seems...
It's all dealt with on a level of political correctness or what?
It seems to be in a vacuum of just Tea Party right-wingers and New Yorkers. I don't see... I mean, there was two protests of 200 people just the other day on opposite sides. They were kept a block apart from each other, one for and one against, and... everybody is finding their own story of somebody who says, yeah, this is wrong. It's insensitive to have it that close. And other people going, this is all of what you tolerance and freedom and,
you know, and this whole, this idea of, you mentioned the Tea Party movement. You know, I think about, Alex Jones and how Alex Jones was one of the real founders of the Tea Party movement. And he now, you know, disavows the Tea Party movement altogether because it's been co-opted by the right wing.
Right.
And this is, God, so much the way, isn't it? I mean, when we had protests against the war as we were leading up to invading Iraq, remember the protests were infiltrated, you know, and so that on the news people would see, oh, violence is breaking out in these protests.
That's right.
You know, so you go, wow. You know, people like me would look at it and go, wait a minute, you want peace and you're getting violent.
Right.
At a peace protest.
Yeah.
You know?
And same thing at
your message is discredited because you as a messenger are not credible. And then you find out later these people were planted.
Yeah.
Much like, you know, going back to the
G20?
Well, 2000. I was thinking in 2000, the election dispute in Florida.
Oh, yeah.
And how people would be hired to come in from out of state to run certain types of protests.
Right, right.
Yeah. You know, they were basically actors being hired or, you know, advocates that had been hired.
And in Toronto, I believe the Ontario Police Force had to admit that they actually placed their own in G20 protester groups to do property damage so that would be a reason for them to go in and break up the whole protest in the first place.
You know, and then that leads us back to our interview subject, Bruno Brewiler of We Are Change LA, a self-identified 9/11 truther being arrested and charged on terrorism. You know, you can come at this from any angle because disinformation is so much a part of the game.
Yeah.
You know, it's like, absolutely, you know, if you wanted to discredit a truth movement, you know, you would plant someone. On the other hand,
why?
What a great idea. What if the truth movement itself is disinformation? You know, what if that was a terrorist
and that's a conspiracy too, right? The conspiracy is the conspiracy.
Yeah.
And you get to that stage.
You know.
And then it goes into that same rabbit hole again of, you know, faith and skepticism that you can just chase.
And so what is the answer to that? Well, again, it becomes our own innate ability, and sometimes we have it and sometimes we don't, but to hold all the possibilities, and to me, to also, again, recognize the fact that each of us individually creates the world that we live in through the questions that we ask.
Right.
And so you can stop your own thinking. You can question your own thinking. Turn back that analysis onto yourself of going, okay, look, before I get bogged down in how do I know what's true? How do I know what's not? Look at the world that's created by your train of thought and by the question that you're asking. And ask yourself, is that a world I want to live in?
Mm-hmm.
You know, and if you are fighting against, if you say that this leads to that, and the Bilderbergers run everything, you know, and I'm going to fight them, well, you know what? You've already decided that that's the world you're living in, where they run everything and where humankind doesn't have any freedom.
Right, right. You know, you've already built
you've that. Given them power by saying you live there. So you try to ask those questions again and be very aware of, okay, where am I putting the power? Where am I giving the power? And I think, you know, when you hear these things of like, oh my God, again, what am I supposed to believe? What am I supposed to know? What am I... Be aware that if you're confused, as we've heard before, sometimes confusion is exactly where you're supposed to be.
Yep.
There's something that's very right about confusion.
Confusion.
And recognize your own ability to create the world that you live in. And so with 9/11, it comes back to certain questions that you can ask, again, regardless of whether you believe it was a false flag operation or whether you believe it was terrorists.
Right.
Questions about, you know, the Patriot Act that can be asked whether or not it was a response directly to a terrorist act or for some sort of hidden agenda
that was already planned long before. Right.
You know, certain questions that you always get to ask, am I going to be on the side of fighting for individual liberties, for the individual's right to express his or her own individuality
right.
as he or she sees fit, according to her own soul's needs and desires, so long as that expression does not infringe upon another individual or individual's rights to do the same.
Right.
And those are questions that it seems to me we can keep coming back to, but those get lost.
Totally get lost.
In the midst of this. As I brought up, you know, last week with the Proposition 8, you know, the court case, you know, Proposition 8 being overturned and then that overturn being stayed and, you know, people going, what happened to the will of the people? And this whole issue of, well, the judicial system was never supposed to be
the will of
about
people.
The will of the people. It was always about this point of, look, are individual rights being protected here, the rights of the individual being protected, that is supposed to be the purpose of the judicial system. And whether you agree with the decision or disagree with the decision, of course, is another kettle of fish. But is the system trying in its own fallible, flawed way, because it is, after all, embodied by people,
right?
But is it in its own way trying to address that particular issue? And, you know, and when I, again, you know, we talked a little bit as regards, you know, same-sex marriage, you know, this religious overtone of, you know, religions defining marriage a certain way, and then seeking that to be reflected in what is a legal contract.
Right.
You know, it's so disturbing for me, and it's not disturbing for me on the same way it might be for other people, because I, of course, know a lot of very thoughtful people who then see, you know, religion as suddenly the enemy in this.
Right.
Right. Or the Mormons are putting up the money for this, or whatever religious group. You know, it's like, no, religion's not the enemy of it. It's just that these people have, again, forgotten, or perhaps never learned, that they have the right to follow their own sense of worship and to express their own belief in a God because of our legal system.
Right.
And that they did not have that. Their ancestors did not have that before coming to this country because of this legal system.
Right. And so you take that for granted, or you never learn it, right, or, you know, that the education system doesn't pass that on.
Right.
And then it sort of collapses in on itself.
You know, it's that, why, like, why would a Jewish ACLU lawyer argue in favor of the rights for the Klan or the American Nazi Party to march?
Right.
Because who knows better how quickly rights can be taken away.
Exactly.
From a particular group. And so you have to argue in favor of the individual rights of every group.
Regardless of what your personal feelings toward them.
Yeah.
Wow. So let's hope that that lesson gets out there.
Yeah. I'm sure podcast. I've just made a big difference. But it does come back to something that we've talked about in terms of, you know, truth is out there and, you know, how to deal with this incredible amount of material that we have. And because I'll constantly, you know, start to get overwhelmed and lost, you know, and you know, I can debate back and forth over, okay, this clip, does this go, does this not go, does this go? You know, and one of the truths that you keep coming back to as you try to shape this and mold this almost like a sculpture, revealing the sculpture that wants to come through, is just make sure you're honoring all voices.
Right.
You know, now that doesn't mean that you don't trim, that you don't, but are you honoring all voices that wish to be heard?
In the documentary.
Yeah, and because only then will the real, you know, architectural sculpture that is this film truly emerge.
Hmm. Wow. Well, there's a lesson for all those out there editing their project right now.
Right.
Allow the architectural sculpture to emerge.
Yeah.
It is in the film itself that you bring out.
And it's in the community. You know, if we honor all the voices, and again, honoring all the voices does not mean to be taken by them,
right,
to be swayed by them, to even think that you have to believe or disbelieve. I mean, that's one of the things that, you know, before we started on this journey of the truth is out there, you know, you and I were just talking one day and we were saying, you know, why not believe people? Most of the time, why not believe them?
Right. Even if they're wrong.
Yeah.
There's no harm.
It's fine.
It's fine.
It's fine.
You're not going to be
believe them.
Taken away.
Nobody's judging you,
right,
because you decided to believe another human being.
Though I did run into somebody going, "Oh, are you the? There's the three gunmen. Oh yeah, I heard one of them went crazy." I go, "Really? Yeah, yeah. He's all into the stuff. He's gone crazy. Oh yeah, that would be me."
It's good weather for it.
It's good weather. Good weather to be crazy.
Yeah, embracing one's madness.
Embracing the madness, I guess.
As the late Dr. Brew Joy once said to me when he asked me how I'd been doing, I said, you know, I've been really, really exploring embracing my madness. And he said, oh, isn't that fun?
Fun is the key word. Absolutely. Like the end of our podcast comes to another hour. Of your Chilpack Hollywood Hour.
Of Dean Haglund's Chilpack Hollywood Hour.
It's been Dean Haglund's crazy Chilpack Hollywood Hour.
You can find every episode
of
your Chilpack Hollywood Hour at our official website, chillpackhollywood.com, C-H-I-L-L-P-A-K, Hollywood.com. You can download it. Mm-hmm. You can stream it. You can mm-hmm. subscribe to it via iTunes.
So easy.
It's so named.
Why?
Because it's roughly an hour each yes. week. Because we are in and of and often discuss Hollywood.
Of the trade.
Which is, of course, much more a state of mind than a...
it's true.
I don't know.
Hardly anything.
But the Chill Pack,
oh,
our sponsor,
uh-huh,
is a gel pack cooling device.
Mm-hmm.
It's an invention.
That's right.
That, you know what it does? It provides a very simple and easy to use and effective solution to what is a very, very complicated and potentially costly problem.
Mm-hmm.
And that is heat and how heat affects the performance and the longevity of your laptop computer.
Right.
Anybody who has a laptop knows how hot it gets.
And you know
that
that's
affects,
dangerous.
Performance and affects its longevity. And the Chill Pack, for very little money, it's like $30, free shipping anywhere in the world.
Till the end of the month.
It takes your laptop computer and keeps it running fast by keeping it cool. Check it out at chillpack.com.
C-H-I-C-H-I-L-L-P-A-K.com.
So it's Chai Chill Pack?
Chai Chill Pack.
Become a liker of the show. Please like on us. Facebook. And welcome to all our new likers from Jackalope Radio, who joined us on Facebook. Facebook.com/ChillPackHollywood. You can become a friend of the show on MySpace, MySpace.com/ChillPackHollywood. Each weekend, we post a blog previewing the coming week's episode.
Absolutely. Follow us on Twitter.
Twitter.com/DHagland.
That's me. And your Twitter.com/PhilLairness.
Absolutely.
Spelt like it sounds.
Okay. Have we forgotten anything?
No, that's it. Of course, we'll be back next week.
With an all new installment.
So we'll see you then.